We also love our old buddy Andrew Wittenberg from KSL in Salt Lake City, Utah. He's had quite a busy week. We haven't talked to Andrew since way back when the Olympics were on. Hey, Andrew, good morning. How are you, sir?
Hey, Matt, how are you? A long time to talk.
I know, it has been. It's been a long time since the Olympics ended, which was, when were the Olympics? It was back in February, right?
Yeah, February, yeah. Pretty much the whole month of February.
Yeah, so it's been about a half year. Has it been nice? When you first got back, since I don't think we talked to you after you returned home, how was it first being back? What was the best thing? Was it, you know, seeing your young child and your wife, or was it just getting in the, I'm sure that we'll separate that, because of course that was the best thing ever. But your own bed, getting back on the time zone, American food, what was like, oh, thank God we're home. What was the biggest thing right away?
Yeah, both times I've done the Olympics in Rio and South Korea, I was definitely trying to find some American junk food pretty quick, you know, aside from the from just hanging out with the fam. But yeah, it's you know, trying to sit down, find a nice greasy burger or a good pizza, sure. Like I hear you guys have in studio tonight. Something like that to get it going.
Yes, we're terrible in the middle of the night. We do order pizza in the middle of the night. So you've been back.
Everything's good, man.
We're good here. You're back on the morning show at KSL. I see your pictures every morning. You're very good with the social media and saying good morning to everybody and getting the day started. I don't get to see the show, of course, because we're here in Chicago, but I see your posts almost daily. You're very good with doing that. So there was a lot of news in Salt Lake City this week. Well, a lot of news on the Elizabeth Smart case, but then I also want to ask you about Olympics, because North and South Korea, and so let's stay in the Olympics for just a second. North and South Korea are going to pitch an Olympics together. And when you were there, you know, there was a lot, you know, at first it was like nervousness about being in South Korea because there had been so much talk between Trump and Korea and threats and Rocket Man and all that stuff that at first we were like a little nervous. Then Korea sends a delegation. Kim Jong-un's sister is there. So things started thawing maybe during those Olympics a little bit. And now here we are to the point that they're actually pitching an Olympics together. Would you have guessed when you were there that this could really start building towards something like this?
I don't think anyone would have guessed that. Man, what a weird and wild period of time. I mean, who would have thought even a year ago that that would have even been possible, what we saw in South Korea, and then especially now, yeah, going back. And I mean, you hope it's all good, and I think everybody sort of has a little bit of sense of trepidation maybe about it. But yeah, I mean, apparently things are moving forward quite well to that point where they're trying to put together this unification bid for 2032, I believe, in the Summer Games of 32. I mean, it seems like everything's going well. It seems like things are going down the right path. And if this is something, you know, you look back on decades later or something and find out that the Olympics of 2018 seemingly put an end to what a 60-year standoff between the North and the South, I mean, that's pretty unbelievable. And I think it's maybe really awesome, maybe a great step for those two countries to have been able to, you know, put up what all the differences that have been built up over decades to unify in a sense. I mean, it is, quite frankly, I mean, almost unbelievable. One of those stories. And who knows what's going on behind the scenes. I mean, I think that's the more interesting aspect of what is actually happening in those sort of back channel communications, if you will, that has made this even possible. And what, if any, role did the United States play with the summit they had in the spring and early summer? We understand there's going to be another summit, perhaps, with the United States involved, the denuclearization, and all sort of intertwined with this Olympics news. I mean, it's just almost wild to even believe that it's possible, but apparently that's what the deal is. The 2032 unified Korea bid to once again host an Olympics, and it's, you know, certainly amazing. I think it's great news, but I would be shocked if everybody wasn't going into it with a little bit of a degree of like I say, trepidation about, well, is this really happening after all of the anxiety and angst and tough talk and action and the wall and the border and everything else, the DMZ that's been built up over these years.
Well, and even if this doesn't completely come to fruition, What we can say, though, is just the things that have happened in the last year haven't happened in the last 50 years, right? These two meeting and shaking hands at the, right? And they met at the line at the, like, that DMZ zone where the, wherever the line is. And wasn't the South Korean leader just in North Korea this week at some sacred mountain that he'd always wanted to visit? So the thawing really has begun. Where it goes, I guess we don't know. And of course, there's trepidation and, you know, reticence on how far this really will go. But even if it doesn't go much farther, it seems that they've really made some progress just in at least being willing to talk to each other about things at this point, right?
An amazing step, yeah. I mean, for a South Korean, a sitting South Korean president to go to Pyongyang for a summit to seemingly, I mean, Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in, they actually hugged on the tarmac when he landed, when President Moon landed. Pretty unbelievable. And yeah, certainly to go take a nice day hike up a mountain and have all these talks about denuclearization. I mean, this is just unheard of, you know, months ago. So yeah, I think everyone is as stunned as we are, but I mean, it certainly seems like things are progressing in the right direction there.
So Andrew, since you've been out there to South Korea for the Winter Olympics and you're just more aware of the location, a joint Olympics in Pyongyang and Seoul, does that even make sense? Like logistically, are those, how far away are those two areas from each other?
I want to say it's about 125 miles or so, give or take. The DMZ, the demilitarized zone, is probably, I mean, it's a couple hours. Well, so it spans the whole country. So the closest point, it is north of Seoul. I want to say it's about 60 miles north of Seoul is the closest point, but it goes the whole basically east-west border, along, the middle part of, you know, the Korean Peninsula. So, yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be the easiest logistically, but I mean, I think certainly if you look at Pyongyang, I want to say it's, you know, like I say, 100 to 200 miles north. They talked about the winter bid. Even there was chatter before these Winter Olympics that, you know, would South Korea try to extend an olive branch and put maybe one of the skiing venues in a North Korean ski resort. I don't think it ever really came close to panning out, but that was sort of rumored, and there had been some discussions about it when they were first trying to get the North Koreans to come to the table and participate in these Olympics. I mean, I think it's possible. It certainly wouldn't be the easiest logistically, but I mean, we're talking about a city with an international airport, as it were, in Pyongyang to the north, albeit quite restricted as of now. But yeah, I mean, I think it's possible, but it certainly wouldn't be, I mean, maybe the easiest logistically, maybe something like you were talking about, Chicago, Milwaukee, or Chicago, Detroit. You know, I don't know how, you know, the specific distances there, right. But I mean, it would be of considerable. Yeah, they're not just like border cities, yeah. Right next, bumped, yeah, up to each other.
But I guess if it's 2032, even if they were to award this in the next 4 years and give them a 10-year head start, I mean, maybe they would build some sort of bullet train infrastructure. Maybe there's something they could do to make it feasible. They certainly would have to figure out a way to kind of open up the borders between each other a little bit, at least for those 3 weeks, to let people go back and forth, right? I mean, they'd really have to,
sure,
come to the table and make some nice agreements with each other if that were to work out.
Which is certainly possible. As far as the actual transportation goes, they put in the high-speed rail system just for these past Olympics in Pyeongchang from Seoul. I mean, they put in a high-speed rail line just for those games. So I think you're talking about something that's a possibility. But, yeah, I mean, the thought, though, even just to think that that would be possible, that those two, where there have been decades of families split up and separated that haven't hardly seen each other, to even think that those barriers would even be possible, the fact that we're even talking about it is pretty wild. And yeah, I mean, you know, South Korea typically a stronger winter Olympics market or country than Summer Olympics, but certainly a huge population, 20 million people or so, a little under, I think, in Seoul and that surrounding metro area, massive city. You know, they have a population that loves the Olympics. They have a country and a region that has endeared themselves to the Olympics. They have shown a propensity for liking to host. I mean, we're in the midst now of three consecutive games that will be in Asia, between Korea, then Tokyo in 2020 for the next Summer Games, and then Beijing in 22. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a possibility again, but I mean, I think the headline of it all is like, what in the world is going on here? And amazing as it is, I think there's definitely some curiosity. Is this even possible? Is the big headline.
Well, and it's probably a good time for them to be doing this because the Olympics are in a bit of a state right now where they're sometimes having trouble. I know they just announced these next few games in Paris and Los Angeles, but they're kind of at a crossroads where it's very expensive and they're not getting as many bids as they'd like. So it might be an opportune time for the Koreas to approach them, right?
Yeah, the news came this week that, you know, which is oftentimes sad for those of us who have been to an Olympic city, that South Korea is looking to actually start to tear down some of those venues from Pyeongchang just, what, 6-7 months after the Games. And that has been a consistent theme going back a long, long time, is that some of these venues have just gone by the wayside in many of the cities. And, you know, I'd be reticent not to mention the fact that our mayor from Salt Lake City right now is in Colorado Springs for the U.S. Olympic Committee meetings, where they're still putting forward more pressure on the USOC to make sure that they know that Salt Lake would be interested in a future Olympic bid. The facilities here that have been maintained, they're very interested in hosting another Olympics. It looks like it would be primarily the interest would be towards 2030, because with Los Angeles getting the 2028 Summer Games, you don't want to step in front of all the marketing deals and all the ad buildup to a big Summer Games, because the money is a little bit better and a little bit higher for the Summer Games as far as TV and ad revenues go. But Salt Lake, Denver, and the Reno, Tahoe area are three cities that I believe all have representatives in Colorado Springs right now, pushing for an American bid in an upcoming Winter Olympics in 26 or 30. And that was the word of the talk this week. These cities are backing out of 26. So much like what happened with Paris and Los Angeles, where they did a joint bid between 24 and 28, does the United States jump in and try to be part of a joint bid for 26 and 30 if they're going to start awarding multiple games at one time, which was unheard of from the IOC just 6 months ago or something.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's interesting, and I think it's one of those situations where, yeah, they're going to start having to realize that the money is just unrealistic for many of the cities, even if they have the public support to do them, which those cities are few and far between. The cities in Europe that have pulled out most recently, I believe there's one in Austria. There have been others, one in Italy that pulled out, Norway, I believe Lillehammer pulled out. It's primarily because of public support. There's a lack of it. It's not initiatives or even fundraising or money. As much as it is, public support just isn't there to try to make this giant. And it is a burden. I mean, people talk about Chicago, how they missed out on 16. It's a considerable burden on a large metropolitan city for a month, not to mention the buildup and the hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, that go into it.
I can't remember how Paris and Los Angeles came together. Was it just those two Olympics, or is it going to go back to Paris then again after Los Angeles? Or no, that wasn't part of the deal?
No, it's just, yeah, I think they agreed that there was sort of, I think,
instead
sort of
fighting
a backroom
against
deal
each other
between
for one, they said, let's bid on these two different years together. That's how it worked out?
Yeah, it was sort of interesting. I don't even really know that the full story is out there, because the public version of it was, well, Paris and Los Angeles, two historic hosting cities for Summer Games, are both interested in hosting Summer Games. The big push was for Los Angeles to host in 24, but Paris had also put in the same time, and they just kind of came out. I believe it was in South America or maybe Peru or somewhere where they had this big meeting or this big decision, this big announcement from the IOC, and they said, hey, while we're here, we're just going to go ahead and award both games to these individual cities. And LA was like, I guess we're fine hosting in 28. And if it means the difference between not getting them at all or hosting 4 years later, we'll take it. And so there you had it. It was Paris, which will be on the 100-year anniversary of Paris hosting in 2024. I think there was some sentimental reasoning behind that, sort of like we had in Athens, Greece. They had pitched when they were coming about that big you know, 100 celebration after Atlanta. There was a pitch for Athens to get a games. And so I think we're seeing the same thing with Paris. They would like to have it on the 100-year anniversary of their 24 games, and then Los Angeles being in there right after, because they had such a big support. They had such a big campaign going as a candidate city for 2024. I think the sentiment would still be there for 28. So they said, yeah, we'll do it.
You know, it's interesting because I think you and I have talked about this before. Because of the expense, because of the buildup, and because of these cities that have had problems then with what do we do with these buildings afterwards, I don't understand why Paris should have 2024 and then, say, 2032. Like, you know, give it to them twice. Give them something to build for, and in between those 8 years, you'll host these national events and these international events, so these venues make sense, and then have a rotating thing. So every couple of years, now I don't know if NBC, who pays billions of dollars, be like, man, we don't want to go to these places twice within 8 years, but I can't imagine that much of the TV aspect depends on this new location. NBC does such a good job of telling the individual stories that, you know, especially if the IOC keeps having problems kind of finding the places, they're going to have to offer better incentives, I would think, to get people to spend $100-some million on a 3-week event. I know here in Chicago, Andrew, when that was going on, I was really excited about the idea. Most of the city was crabby about the idea of the Olympics. People did not want the headaches of it. I was really surprised at the angst it was drawing on us making that bid. And the bid itself, which was all privately raised donations, cost like $72 million just for the bid. It was insane.
Yeah, it is tremendous, the cost. I mean, you think about essentially shutting down an entire city for a month, which on a very idealistic, you know, standpoint, you're like, oh, well, it's a month. You know, what's the big deal? This is great to have the exposure. It's great to have the eyes of the world on our city. And certainly Chicago obviously has so much culturally to offer, and as far as athletics goes, one of the unparalleled cities in the world. But yeah, I think it's difficult to get the average mainstream person to look at this and say this is a good idea, because you're virtually guaranteed nothing on the back end. Most cities have venues which falter within a year, or certainly 2 to 4 years after the Olympics, these venues go unused. And I think, again, that's what is, you know, the city leaders and state leaders in Utah have championed, and that's why they try to do that. There's been a sentiment, particularly on the winter side of these games, that there would be maybe 3 rotating host cities, maybe 4. So every 12 or 16 years, you're going back to these places. So they, number one, have something to look forward to keep the facilities and the venues up and running. And then number two, so there aren't games in cities that don't want them. So yeah, you look at maybe like a Salt Lake or a Denver or a Reno Tahoe for the United States to host, or a North American city. I doubt Vancouver would be a great option. But maybe like a, I don't know, Calgary or something for the winter games in North America, and then maybe a city in Norway for the European winter games that rotate, and then a city in Asia. So it would be not a tremendous difficulty for travel around the world every 12 years, but that would also expose different areas of the world for the games and different cultures and people. Whereas the summer, it's a little bit more varied as to who can host. You know, there's obviously a lot of cities that that have the ability in North America, South America, Europe, Asia. There's a lot of more variety there. But winter markets, it's tough. You got to find a place with a big international airport, with the mountain venues, with the coastal venues. And so that's why I think that sentiment is there. I think you got a little bit more flexibility in the summer.
Andrew, I'd really love to talk a little bit about Elizabeth Smart, but I've got to do the news. Can you hang on for a couple more minutes and chat a little more?
Absolutely.
All right, excellent. Hold on 1 second. Coming up, the stories that matter with Roger Badish from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. Get to the news right after this. Pour yourself something cold, baby. Cheers. I was just trying to floss. Sometimes you didn't do it well. Matt Bobala with you, 720 WGN. Hopefully the cameras did not pick
that
up.
I missed it by a split second.
Well, you need to start practicing, Roger.
Yeah, that's not going to...
Get the overnight flossing crew going. Andrew,
really?
Yes, that's what we're going to do. Our buddy Andrew Wittenberg from KSL in Salt Lake City, Utah, is still on the phone with us. Andrew, have you ever done the floss dance?
I've not yet. You know, I've seen so many kids doing it.
Yes.
And my little guy is still a little young yet to have picked it up. But everywhere you go, these kids are doing it. It's wild, huh?
The good thing for you is your son is young enough that he's not yet embarrassed by you, because my youngest, my triplets are 13. And so when I say, oh, I'm going to floss, they freak out. Like, don't you dare.
Oh, no.
Don't you dare.
That is total dad embarrassment right there.
God, I love being the embarrassing dad.
I'm afraid I'm going to break something doing it.
You might, Roger. My age. You might lose a hip. Yeah. You might just throw a hip right out.
Yeah.
So, Andrew, let's talk for a couple of minutes on a more serious note about the Elizabeth Smart case. And one of her kidnappers, Wanda Barzi, was released this week. Take us back, because it's been a long time, and give us the 60-second refresher on what happened here. Elizabeth Smart was a teenager who was kidnapped. How many years later was it when she was discovered and found?
Man, that story is such a big one here in Utah. And oddly enough, sort of tied into the Olympics that we were just talking about before the break there. In a span of 6 months, 8 months, we had September 11th, 2001. We had been hosting the Winter Olympics February 2002. And then about 3 months later, Elizabeth Smart was 14 years old, taken from her home in an affluent area right in essentially downtown Salt Lake City by a man who's serving a life sentence right now, Brian David Mitchell. And was basically held captive for 9 months, and between California and here in Utah, and then ultimately was discovered, like walking out of a grocery store, if I'm not mistaken, with this guy. Elizabeth Smart was found, seen by just an onlooker. I mean, all the national networks were here. It was such big news as that 24-hour media cycle had really started to crank up in the early 2000s, and she was just found. And just as seemingly as big of a story as it had been on that period of time in late 2002, it was sort of, not to say over, but it was just so shocking that they were just walking the streets down in Sandy, which is about 15 miles or so south in a suburb of Salt Lake. And so anyway, Brian David Mitchell goes away. He's serving a life sentence, but it was his wife, this Wanda Barzi, who was a co-conspirator. She was found to be complicit with all of the torture and the sexual abuse that was ongoing for those 9 months, was just released this past week, a few days ago. It's a fascinating turn in this case, and Elizabeth Smart and the whole family was, as you can imagine, quite upset by it and the circumstances that surrounded it. But yeah, she is a free woman here in Utah as of Wednesday.
And so in July, Barzi was denied parole, but then after further review and advice from legal counsel, I'm reading a story, that was the quote, they realized they must credit her time in federal prison toward her current term in state custody on top of time she had already served in jail in a state hospital. So basically they had added up wrong, and now it's not just whether or not she's denied parole, but she's actually served all the time that she was ordered to serve. Is that what basically happened?
Basically, yeah. So there was federal charges and state charges that that came about as a result of this whole thing. She was deemed unfit to stand trial for, I want to say, close to 7 years. So you do the math here, from 2002 to 2018, it's 16 years. She was found unfit to stand trial, was in I believe the Utah State Hospital for 7 years, and then ultimately did go to trial, was found guilty, and in that period she was given 1 to 15 years federal sentence and 1 to 15 years from a state sentence. And so the decision that came this week, or actually came a couple of weeks ago when we found out she was going to be released, was that they had not been giving her credit for time served while she was in the state hospital, 7 years. So here we are. It was supposed to be right at 2024, I think, was the year she was supposed to be released, is what everybody had thought. But by that point, another, 6 years from now, she would have been 78 years old. So she's 72 years old now. But then the news came that, you know, they'd not been giving, it's this whole concurrent versus consecutive, the way they determine sentences and who is getting credit for what time served. And they just said, well, hey, we made a mistake because we haven't given her credit for the 7 years, basically, that she was in state custody in the hospital. And while trying to become fit for trial, or they were attempting to find someone that would deem her fit, for trial. And so they decided that they had not given her enough credit for time served. And ultimately they said, hey, her sentence is going to run out because of how this is all handled. And she was released early Wednesday morning.
I don't remember the trial or anything like that because it's so long ago now. But in reading what Elizabeth Smart was saying this week, that she stood right by there, she encouraged him. It's surprising to me that she got such a soft sentence in a way. I mean, I know 20 years or so is a good sentence, but he's got two life sentences for this. And she is a co-conspirator, even if she wasn't the one sexually abusing her, encouraging it, as Elizabeth Smart said, being right there for it. Are you surprised? Do you remember how this went down? Or did they write it all this week about why she got such a smaller sentence compared to her husband?
You know, I don't think anyone ever really thought that she would see the light of day again. And so the fact that it came about,
and she testified against him, I suppose, so that probably helped her too in her sentencing, right?
Sure. Yeah, there was a lot going on there. And that's a little before my time in Utah when the trial was happening in 2009. But the sort of view from 30,000 feet on that is that, yeah, she cooperated with authorities. She essentially copped to all the charges and helped put away the kidnapper for life, essentially. He'll never see the light of day again. But then I think everybody sort of thought, I mean, she's 72 years old. Wait a second. What is that going to put her, like, at 54, you know, when she was first found and this whole process started, you know, what, 16 years ago? So she would have been 56. So she's 56. I think people think, all right, 1 to 15, 1 to 15, and she serves the max, and you do the math. Well, she's not really, if she ever does see the light of day, she'll be older and not able to impart any of this just viciousness and awful crime upon anyone else. Well, then all of a sudden, here it comes, and she's 72, and she's, you know, relatively, I guess, decent health enough, you know, to get up and walk out of prison. Although there is still some health concerns there, both mental and physical. I don't think anyone really thought about it for all this time. And then all of a sudden when the news comes, I think that's the biggest reaction, is that, wait a second, how did this person that did perhaps the most evil of torture and complicit in watching, and oh my gosh, the details are just horrific. How could this happen? And I think that's what the big shock is here. And both Utah nationally this week, is that how did this seemingly slip under the cracks when there really wasn't any sort of slip under the cracks? It was just sort of the way the penalties worked and time served, and here we are. But it's just a sort of perplexing story, as she's now out here and, you know, sort of supervised release right now for a period of 5 more years. So it's not like she's actually just, you know, scot-free kind of thing, but there's certainly a lot to it and a lot of shock and awe here.
Yeah, what was the public reaction to it? Is the public understanding of this, or is there a lot of anger towards the judicial system that is letting this woman out much earlier than was expected?
Yeah, I think it's mixed. I think you have the, well, she served her time crowd, and, you know, she should, under the penalty of the law, she should be allowed to, you know, try to live whatever remaining life she has left. Albeit here in Utah, that's going to be quite substantial because, I mean, she's as recognized of a face as anyone.
Yeah.
And then I think you have the other crowd of people who say, well, wait a second, what is going on here? Like, we need to address this, or this is not right, just because of the horrific nature of this crime and this abduction. And this just isn't like a one-off thing. I mean, it's not like a, you know, a small misdemeanor or something. This is incredibly significant violations of someone. And, you know, I think people that just weren't, well, she'll never see the light of day again. I think it was sort of out of sight, out of mind for all these years. And no one was really crossing the T's, dotting the I's. In the meantime, attorneys in the background are working and doing what they can for their client. Because she has a federally appointed attorney,
right,
and saying, hey, wait a second here, this wasn't calculated right. You know, the whole, what was getting the time on the federal sentence, because she served her federal sentence and she gets kicked back on the state charges, and that's only a couple years. So she ran out of her federal sentence in 2016, and then the state sentence just ran out, essentially. And so because she got all that time served, or a credit for time served, when she was in the Utah State Hospital. So I don't know. There's two crowds, and they're both very vocal. We saw sort of on social media and whatnot in Utah this week. But boy, I mean, it's just another gut-wrenching turn in this story that so many people here have followed for, what, 16 years. It's tough.
Elizabeth Smart herself, I know, was speaking out about this week coming up and leading up to the release. So she was public. Has she been very public over the years? I know she's moved on. She's married. She has kids. And once in a while you'll see her in People magazine, things like that. But there in Utah, is she a public figure, or does she mostly just go about trying to lead her own life?
Well, she still lives here in Utah, which is, you know, I would imagine tough in and of itself because she is such a recognizable face here. She does the speaking circuit, a lot of motivational speaking.
Okay.
I believe she has a rather large charitable foundation about surviving sexual abuse and does a lot of good work. She and her father both do a lot of community and charity work in trying to raise money and help and be victims advocates, that sort of thing. But so, yeah, still very much here in the forefront in not only Utah, but on the national speaking circuits and things like that as well, raising awareness, sort of thing. So they're very, yes, out there in the public eye. She and her father have both been very outspoken, in the past 2 weeks about this, how they were unhappy about the, and I hesitate to call it a loophole because it wasn't really a loophole. But they were hesitant, or that they were out speaking about how atrocious this is, that this was even possible in the first place, just that she would get out. You know, but that, again, that's a tough, when you talk about, well, letter of the law and the sentencing and what charges were brought against her, you know, you would say, I guess, hey, she did her time, this Bar Z woman, but boy, that is a tough pill to swallow for someone who was abducted for 9 months and is now a wife and a mother herself. To stomach, and you can imagine why.
Yeah, absolutely, and especially raising two young kids, I just can't imagine. And it is surprising to think that, you know, I imagine everybody thought, well, she'll never see the light of day again, but if she was only 56, 20 years, and with life expectancy, this day was bound to come, you know? So I wonder if what's going on with elections up there? Will this be a political football at all? That how could we have let this happen?
You know, I don't know. We do have a significant election this year, and I don't know that this will really come to bubble in the surface of it. But the Senate race to replace Orrin Hatch, wow. and Mitt Romney is a candidate for Senate,
right?
And facing a Democratic challenger, Jenny Wilson. It's presumed, you know, Romney has a massive lead in the polls here, so very popular, obviously, as a former presidential candidate. I don't know that this will rise to the level. I think this would be more on the state and local level where this would get a lot of play, and I just don't know that that connection will be made here in the next month and a half. But, you know, it's certainly, I mean, I think judicial practice and judicial law is something that isn't as sexy of a topic for politicians to sure. dive into. It may become a talking point. There's some debates even coming up, I believe, next week to where it may be addressed, but I doubt it's anything that would rise to the level of being something that would move the needle for one candidate or the other, especially in a big national race, the Senate race, the U.S. Senate race here. But perhaps locally, yeah, but I just don't see it being something that really moves the needle.
All right, Andrew, the next Olympics will be Summer Olympics, and where is the next set at?
Well, let's see. It's Tokyo 2020, so just about two years away from Tokyo, and everybody was looking forward to that because there's been such a buildup for Tokyo and Japan. They've been so eager to get this technological advances, such a big and vibrant city in Asia. This is going to be a monstrous Games. I mean, you look back to, I'd say, London in 2012, maybe Atlanta in 96, or gosh, I mean, maybe Beijing in 08, but certainly this will be a monstrous Olympic Games. There'll be a lot of buildup, a lot of attention paid to it, and a lot of advertising dollars that we'll start to see ads for this, gosh, I would imagine, in 6 months to a year's time with people starting to get ready to go down that qualifying process.
Yeah, that'll be cool. And I know it's far off, but your assumption that we'll be talking to you from there in a year and a half or 2 years, or is that
too far? Oh, man, no one would love it more than me. I don't know. We'll see.
All right.
I mean, it's sort of a just, it's an assignment like any other, you know, but it's great. I mean, obviously it's an amazing assignment, and having done two now, I'd hope that that would be an option for me, but yeah. We'll see. I mean, it's a competitive world out there to get into these Olympics, and especially from a coverage and a broadcasting standpoint, a lot of folks who would love that assignment. So hopefully, you know, hopefully I would really love to. I love the Olympics, man. It's been fun doing these past two.
I'm sure.
And albeit the time away from home, that is a massive downside, of course, but just to be on that world stage, it's a really cool thing. And no matter what's going on politically around the world, or even in a region like we saw in Korea or Rio and in Brazil, the world seems to come together. And I think that's one of the great things about this time right now is particularly interesting and amazing about the Olympics is that everyone just sort of puts everything aside and likes to enjoy the best that there is in sport.
Next time you're in Salt Lake City, turn on KSL and you'll see Andrew Wittenberg on the morning news. You can follow him on Twitter at KSLAndrew. It's so much fun to chat with you. I really appreciate you staying up late for us. We'll talk to you again soon.
All right, man. Good to talk to you. We'll be watching that North Side-South Side rivalry tomorrow for sure. Cubbies took one on the chin tonight, huh?
They did. The Sox stuck it to them pretty good tonight, so we'll see what happens.
Hey, well, you know, my Braves are looking good, though. I grew up down south in Nashville, so I'm a Braves guy. Braves looking pretty good. I heard you guys having that little discussion earlier.
Braves had quite a turnaround this year. That was unexpected. I mean, you didn't think they were going to be battling for division going into this season, did you?
Oh, no. Everybody thought they were 2 years away.
Yeah.
For sure. And a guy in Brian Snitker, their manager now, that has seemingly come from the assistant coaching ranks. Yeah, he's got them playing well.
Yeah. Well, we'll check in maybe during the playoffs then, Andrew. How about that?
Sounds good, buddy.
All right, thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon. That is our friend Andrew Wittenberg from KSL in Salt Lake City. Okay, we got to take a break, catch up, do the news. Lots to do here at 312-981-7200 is the number. Matt Bobala with you on 720 WGN.